Deconstructing Dinner is made possible in part by the generous support of Ryerson University's G. Raymond Chang School of Continuing Education. The Chang School offers a post-degree certificate in food security and can be completed entirely through the convenience of distance education.
For information about this unique distance education program, visit ryerson.ca/ce/food security.
From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman, your host for the next hour. In the coming weeks, we'll be featuring more episodes of our series on ethnobiology, the local grain revolution, and Bill C-474, calling for changes to the approval of genetically engineered seeds in Canada. But today, we'll look back on two segments that aired over the past few years, the first from July 19th, 2007, when I chatted with author Christopher O'Brien about his book Fermenting Revolution, How to Drink Beer and Save the World. And in the last quarter of the show, a revisiting of our March 13th, 2008 episode, when we aired part two of our ongoing Deconstructing Dinner in Our Schools series, featuring 10-year-old Kodiak Morasky, who, after watching the industrial meat expose in well-known animated film The Matrix, went on to conduct his own research and share his findings about the disturbing nature of industrial meat with his grade 4 classmates. For many people, it would be quite a welcoming bit of advice to learn that drinking beer could save the world from perhaps an unpredictable changing climate, from pollution, from corporate-driven political agendas, from declining levels of happiness, from increasing levels of stress, from gender inequality, from families and relationships falling apart, and from communities that have lost their sense of community. That would no doubt be a lot to ask from a simple pint of beer. But author Christopher O'Brien places those questions on the bar, so to speak, in his book Fermenting Revolution, How to Drink Beer and Save the World. The book was released in 2006 by British Columbia's New Society Publishers, and Deconstructing Dinner spoke with Christopher in March 2007. Located on the back cover of Fermenting Revolution is a warning that reads the following. Reading this book may lead mere beer drinkers to become beer activists, ready to fight corporate rule by simply meeting their neighbors for a pint at the local brewpub. Fermenting a revolution, one beer at a time. When not writing books, author Christopher O'Brien works as the Director of Sustainability at American University in Washington, D.C., and has in the past worked as Director of the Responsible Purchasing Network at the Center for a New American Dream and Managing Director of the Co-op America Business Network and the Fair Trade Federation. Christopher is also part owner of the Seven Bridges Cooperative, which is a supplier of certified organic beer-making ingredients. In order to make the point that beer can help save the world, Christopher spends a notable amount of time in the book focusing on the history of beer and its role in shaping societies and culture. My conversation with Christopher began with the suggestion that beer acted as the foundation upon which the first human civilizations were built.
The evidence all shows that the earliest settled urban civilizations were founded on the ability to consistently grow, store, and convert grain into consumable nutrition. The key thing to understand in this transformation of humanity from nomadic people to settled urban people is that we were able to harness the power of agriculture. And barley, in particular, was the grain of choice. And what was done with most of that barley was that it was converted into beer. And part of the reason that was such an advantage was because fermented foods of all kinds add nutrition to food, or rather, what they do is unlock nutrition. So the example I like to use, although it's a little bit gross, is that if you think of eating a handful of corn, and then, you know, a little bit later on, you find that maybe not all that corn really did much inside your body, and it just kind of came right out. Your body didn't metabolize it, so it didn't benefit from the nutrition in that corn. What fermentation does is breaks down the nutrition inside food, in this case, corn or any other grain like barley, which is the grain that's typically used for beer. It breaks down the outer barrier around the husk of the grain, and unlocks the nutrition inside. So beer is this huge nutritional advance for humankind, because all of a sudden we're able to take these grains that are highly nutritious but that the body can't do much with, and now all of a sudden not only does the body able to access the nutrition, but it tastes really good too and makes you feel good.
According to Christopher O'Brien, the ancient Egyptians were frequent drinkers of beer and held it to such high regard that Isis, the first Nubian earth fertility goddess, was later referred to by the ancient Egyptians as the Lady of Green Crops and the Lady of Beer. It appears drinking beer and fertility had a lot in common, and Christopher explains.
The Egyptians were extraordinary beer drinkers. Some examples: the laborers who built the pyramids were actually paid in beer. The pyramids themselves contain rooms that were physically loaded with beer so that the pharaohs who were buried in them would have a physical cache of beer to carry them into the next world. But that physical store would eventually be depleted, so the Egyptians went one step further and symbolically etched into the walls brewsters, in fact, women who made beer, into the walls so that these beer rooms would have a symbolic infinite supply of beer so that the pharaohs would never run out of beer. It was very central to the economy and the spiritual practice of Egyptians, which is very tightly linked, again, back to this concept of agriculture. It was the ability to use agriculture that allowed civilizations like Egypt and Sumer, which is slightly to the east of Egypt in what's modern-day Iraq, where one of the earliest civilizations evolved, it was that ability to use agriculture that allowed those civilizations to thrive. So it's no wonder that they would worship and link conceptually crops with fertility and the beer that they produced from those crops.
Fermenting Revolution also spends a notable amount of attention on gender roles and beer production. As Christopher explains, it was only recently that the culture of beer shifted from resting within the hands of women and into then the hands of men. In his book, Christopher uses descriptions like the masculinization of beer, which we'll learn more about in just a moment. But first, he speaks about his reference to himself as a femaleist, with capitals A-L-E.
I'm a femaleist in the sense that I believe that beer, at its best, tends to exude feminine qualities, or at least qualities that we tend to attribute to women. And I don't believe in, nor do I want to address, the nature versus nurture debate. I'm not saying that women and men are inherently different. In fact, I think women and men are practically nearly the exact same in terms of nature, and it's probably mostly nurture that makes us different. But in the real world, we tend to attribute things like cooperation to women and competition to men. We tend to attribute things like nurturing itself, the idea of motherhood and women raising children are traits that we tend to assign to women, whereas, again, this kind of aggressive, competitive attributes are the kinds of things that we tend to attribute to men. And for me, beer, at its best, tends to evoke those feminine attributes. And that has always been the case. Beer, simply put, beer has always been a beverage produced and controlled by women until very recent modern times, when men turned beer into an industrial commodity, essentially, through the process of the Industrial Revolution. And with that transformation from something feminine into something more masculine, the end result, to put it kind of bluntly, is the advertisements we see during the Super Bowl, which appeal to fairly base male instincts of just being kind of macho and not terribly smart, which are all things that I think are a shame, because beer can really lend itself towards intellectual debate, towards some of the higher qualities that humans can develop, but we've pandered to the lowest common denominator of kind of basic male attributes in recent times. And I'm a femaleist in the sense that I'd like to see beer recapture some of those feminine qualities. And I think the craft beer movement is, in fact, doing that.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, where we're listening to segments from my conversation with Christopher O'Brien, author of the book Fermenting Revolution: How to Drink Beer and Save the World, a book that no doubt upon reading will dramatically change the way we identify with purchase, and consume beer. The book points out the myriad ways through which our beers might either be destroying our planet and our communities, or alternatively are respecting the earth and enriching our lives and our health. As Christopher just explained, women have historically been the brewer of beer, and while this has certainly shifted in Western cultures, in some parts of the world the role of women continues to be integral.
In much of the world, much of Asia, much of Africa, women still do make beer at home. I've traveled pretty extensively around Africa and have found the traditional role of providing food for the family is still generally a woman's role, and beer is part of that food. That's something that's still in the domain of women. I lived in Ethiopia recently, and you could go into just about any village and find signposts outside of people's houses. There would be a stick in the ground with an empty can hanging on the top, and that meant that the woman of the house had beer available. You could just walk in, sit down in the living room, and for a very nominal charge, get a serving of beer that's straight from her kitchen. And then when she ran out of beer, she might brew again in a week or she might brew again in a month, but chances are her neighbor or someone down the street is going to be brewing when she isn't. So it's actually a very nice way of distributing that role throughout the community so that women, again, being at home and having the responsibility of childcare, brewing on an occasional basis like this is still very important to women in places where they still do it, because it's one of the few easily accessible forms of cash that they can earn. Given a cash-based economy, it's more and more important that people are able to earn hard income. Women tend to do lots of work that doesn't earn cash income. It's basically uncounted work. But brewing is one way that they can brew when they have time, in between taking care of the children, in between taking care of the garden. They can brew when they have a chance and earn some income, and then let their neighbor do it the next time.
While women continue to brew beer at home in some regions of the world, the role of brewing in industrialized nations has mostly shed its female roots. In his book, Fermenting Revolution, Christopher suggests that beer itself was even a major contributor to help launch the Industrial Revolution. And behind that shift were men.
It really began with the Industrial Revolution itself. The Industrial Revolution took what had been, by and large, an agricultural and craft-based society and transformed it into one that was focused around industrial production. And with that, social roles changed dramatically. There were massive migrations of human beings all around the world as a result of industrialization. Tens of thousands of people every year left Europe and moved to the New World. That was a massive migration of people, and it was people looking for jobs and opportunity. They had been, in many cases, had lost their ability to provide for themselves, in part because of the transformation of their role as agriculturalists to the need for cash. This was kind of the beginning of the predominance of cash in the economy. People could no longer really be subsistence farmers in Europe. They needed to get jobs in factories, and a lot of those factories were in the New World, where the raw ingredients were cheap, or where the gathering of the raw materials was incredibly cheap. So people moved, and women's roles changed as a result of this. Men needed to leave the household in order to get cash-paying jobs. This left women in a position where they had even more responsibility over the household because the man was often no longer around. And not only was he no longer around the household as much, he may even be in a different country, may have moved from England to America and was trying to get the family to come over when he had established himself. Or he had moved from Philadelphia to Ohio because he was pioneering the frontier, looking for opportunity on the frontier, oftentimes leaving the family behind. This started contributing to a real breakdown of social roles. And in the U.S. in particular, one of the ways of coping with this massive change in society was alcohol, in particular hard alcohol in North America, because it wasn't very practical to carry barrels of beer across the frontier with you. But if you could condense that into whiskey, or rum, that was a lot more easily transportable along the frontier, and in fact became a commodity of exchange itself. That in a cash-strapped existence on the frontier, people used rum and whiskey as a barter commodity. So, and people being away from their families turned towards a drink much more often. Or even if they were with their families, but they were in a city working in a factory maybe 15 hours a day, you know, this is prior to any strong labor laws, life was hard. And so they looked to alcohol as a release from a very difficult lifestyle where they may no longer have the community support structures that they had in the old country. The long-term effect of this was that women ended up rejecting alcohol, basically targeting alcohol as the culprit, when really the culprit of the social transformation was industrialization.
Christopher O'Brien, author of the book Fermenting Revolution. On today's episode of Deconstructing Dinner, we're revisiting our July 2007 interview with Christopher. Later on the show, we'll also be revisiting with a March 2008 segment featuring 10-year-old Kodiak Maraski, who, upon viewing the animated industrial meat expose, The Meatrix, became inspired to inform his grade 4 classmates about the downsides to factory-farmed meat. Today's episode is archived online at deconstructingdinner.ca in the July 8th, 2010 broadcast. As heard in that last clip, Fermenting Revolution recounts the shifts that beer took throughout the Industrial Revolution, and the book follows up that history lesson by suggesting how such an important beverage that was appropriated by industrial processes can be reclaimed from the handful of corporations who now dominate the industry.
We're conflicted. On the one hand, prohibition was an overwhelming voice of society saying we have a problem with alcohol. On the other hand, we have 10,000 years of history prior to that saying actually beer is one of the most central assets of civilization and it should be not only celebrated but even worshipped. So we have this historical memory that beer is something that's good, but we have this very recent memory that beer, or really hard liquor, because hard liquor was really the target of prohibition, is something bad. So we now kind of don't really know what to think about alcohol. It's kind of a, like you say, a guilty nudge-nudge, wink-wink, you know, had a couple drinks last night, as if that's something to be ashamed of, because, in fact, you know, some Americans still do feel, you know, that alcohol is a social bad, whereas the majority of people, even today, do consume alcohol. So we haven't really resolved that yet, and I think part of the resolving that is taking beer back from the corporations and making it something that's of the people again. It's not a commodity to be bought and sold, but it's something to actually be appreciated and celebrated, integrated into our food ways, if you will. You know, something that is part and parcel to a good meal, something that's part and parcel to a family or community celebration, something that brings us together rather than divides us. And I think craft beer is doing just that. And so I think it will take a long time. Social change is very slow, but eventually there'll be a tipping point, I think, and you know, and we'll reach the point where it's embraced again as something that contributes to society rather than detracts from it.
One of the most interesting facts found in Fermenting Revolution is that reclaiming beer from irresponsible hands has been done before, by the founding fathers of the United States. They had launched what essentially was the first Drink Local campaign in an effort to gain independence from Britain. It's an encouraging example for anyone wishing to use beer as a tool to gain one's own independence and self-determination.
That's exactly what it was. The founding fathers of the United States of America very intentionally stimulated a local beer industry, specifically as a way of declaring independence from Great Britain. You know, the concept is that simple. As long as we're dependent on imports from the empire that we just severed ourselves from, we'll continue to be dependent. And as a new nation, we want to be independent. We want to rely on our own ability to provide for our needs. So one of the first laws that was passed in the new nation of the U.S. was that local beers should be subsidized. That American beers should be subsidized, and the result was that breweries started opening up all over the place. Prior to that, you know, people who really wanted good traditional English ales would get them imported from England. You know, with independence, that really changed, and most of the founding fathers themselves were brewers. Many of them had their own home breweries, and many of them had commercial breweries. In fact, they also had distilleries, and some of them made wine. But beer was really very central to establishing our economic independence from empire, which is just another way of saying support the local economy rather than globalizing the economy in a way that's kind of irrational. We can grow barley just as well here and make it here, so why should we be shipping it across the ocean?
Also in need of addressing when speaking about the role that beer can play to change the world are the agricultural methods used to cultivate beer's primary ingredients. Christopher O'Brien writes about this in Fermenting Revolution.
I mean, the good news and bad news here is that beer is, you know, what most people would consider a natural product. In other words, it's not made from an unsustainable source of raw materials, you know, things that are extracted and not replaced, like petroleum. It's made from renewable resources, i.e. barley, hops, water, and yeast. However, how we grow barley and hops is another matter. And in fact, the unfortunate reality is that barley and yeast are both highly chemically intensively grown, by the conventional industrial agriculture industry. Hops in particular, one of the things that I like to point out about hops and chemicals is that what one country considers a safe pesticide to spray on hops, another country may not. And in fact, what we find, if you compare a number of countries like Germany and the U.S., for example, the number of pesticides that are allowed and prohibited in each dramatically different. Many of the pesticides that are used in the U.S. on hops are actually explicitly prohibited in Germany. And the ironic thing is, the opposite is also true. America prohibits the use of certain pesticides that are allowed in Germany. And so what that points out to me is that we're dealing with a lot of unsafe chemical applications in our food supply. And even large, smart nations, so-called, can't agree on what's safe and what's not. So why not choose what we know is safe, which is organic? And actually, in increasing numbers, brewers are turning to organic. At least here in the U.S., I'm seeing organic beers popping up all over the place. And I think there's been a recent controversy about defining what organic means in the context of beer in the U.S., at least. And I think the very fact that we're having that controversial debate is an indication that there's a market there. Otherwise, we wouldn't be, Anheuser-Busch wouldn't bother to be arguing about what should count as organic beer unless they were interested in tapping the market for it, which they clearly are because they have two organic beers. So I think there's actually a great latent demand in the marketplace for more organic beer, and brewers are starting to recognize that. There are some problems that we face, particularly with hops, which is that while malted barley is available in a fairly stable supply, organic hops are not quite so widely available, and definitely not available grown domestically in North America. They're almost exclusively imported from Europe and New Zealand. So what I'd like to see is for us to stimulate an organic hop growing industry back here in America, where, frankly, and I'll put my biases right, wear them right on my sleeve, some of the best hops in the world are grown in the Pacific Northwest, and it's just a shame that we can't get them organically.
Christopher O'Brien. So with industrial beers being just as dependent on fossil fuels as most foods, shifting our beer choices can no doubt have a significant impact on the health of our water, soil, and air, just as our food choices might be able to shift that too. It's this, among other reasons, why Christopher writes in Fermenting Revolution that, quote, if beer helped create civilization, then perhaps it also has a role to play in preventing its collapse.
The scary and sad truth is that we are on the verge of ecological collapse. Climate change is now well-established science that if we don't change our consumption habits, particularly around our use of fossil fuels, we will face devastating consequences. And in fact, many argue we're already seeing some of those consequences with some of the extreme weather events that we're seeing. And of course, with the most unsustainable human endeavor of all, war. Thousands of people are dying as a result of a war based around the scarcity of a commodity that we're completely and totally addicted to, which is petroleum. So I posit the question, could beer, which helped create some of the industrial breakthroughs. In fact, many of the scientific breakthroughs during the Industrial Revolution were actually done by brewers or scientists that were working for brewers. Pasteur, for example, Louis Pasteur basically was studying fermentation as his primary scientific breakthrough. Likewise, the microscope, thermometers, these were all tools of brewers, and they were developed and honed in order to be used by brewers. So the question is, brewers in some ways were the cause of industrialization, and so don't we bear some responsibility to fix some of the problems that we created? Some of the largest industrial operations of the time, and when I say of the time, I'm referring to the 1800s, were breweries, specifically in London. Some of the largest industrial operations in the world were porter breweries. Porter was a very industrialized beer. And so today, what can we do to undo some of the harm that industrialization has brought? Well, I think the good news is that brewers are, in fact, pioneering environmental practices and technologies. You look across North America, and you'll find brewers, both small and large, innovating things like waste recovery, byproduct reuse, energy efficiency, and renewable energy use. In fact, right there in British Columbia, you have one of my favorite breweries, which is called Cranog Ales. They're basically an integrated, closed-loop, farm-based brewery. They produce much of the ingredients that they rely on, and the waste products go to processes right on their farm, and it's a very closed loop. I think they only sell in kegs and growlers, both of which are reusable packages. They don't ship very far. I think they only sell within their immediate area. Other brewers are using solar panels. A good number of breweries are sourcing wind power to power their breweries. There are breweries like New Belgium that has a living roof on one of their main buildings. There are breweries like Anderson Valley in California that are using what's called living machines to clean the water that comes out of the brewery. Water is the number one most important ingredient in beer because it comprises 90-95% of every beer. So it's important to make sure that our water supply is safe and secure. So brewers have taken the responsibility of making sure that the wastewater that comes out of their brewery, they're going to clean it up. They're not going to just put it back into the municipal water supply and force taxpayers to pay the bill. Instead, many are using this really innovative environmental concept of using living organisms to feed on the waste in water and thereby cleaning the water with living organisms. And that's what's called a living machine, and a number of breweries are using that now. So I think the answer is yes, brewers do have a responsibility to help pioneer more sustainable production models, and that they actually are doing just that. Another good example is that Anheuser-Busch is the world's largest aluminum recycling company. They actually recycle one can for every can that they produce. So they're approaching net zero impact in terms of their aluminum use. Aluminum mining is a different story, which is still very environmentally harmful. But the idea is if you can take the waste stream and reconvert it back into useful products again, you're doing going a long way to preventing the unsustainable withdrawal of natural resources and the unsustainable disposal of natural resources.
To wrap up this first segment of today's episode, where we're deconstructing beer and the book Fermenting Revolution, we can touch on one more important factor to consider for anyone wishing to ferment revolution. How healthy is beer? It's certainly not a common message that beer could somehow be healthy. But Fermenting Revolution is filled with information about how beer is indeed a very healthy beverage, and that the public has been kept ill-informed of such benefits.
I dedicate the longest chapter in my book to the issue of health and alcohol. And that's because, as you say, there is widespread misconception about health and alcohol. The general common sense wisdom is that drinking is bad for you. End of story. And that's really unfortunate that we have that as our common wisdom, because exactly the opposite is true. And this is not an off-the-cuff claim that I'm making myself, based on anecdotal evidence. This is based on stacks of studies done by huge scientific-based organizations, tests done on tens of thousands of participants, and the conclusion is uniform, which is that alcohol in general, and this is not peculiar to beer, alcohol in general, when consumed consistently and in moderation, drastically improves health. In particular, it improves heart health. And the number one cause of death in industrial society, especially in North America, is heart disease. Most studies say that a reduction in heart disease of between 30 and 40% is seen in moderate drinkers compared to people who don't drink at all. In other words, if you're not drinking consistently and moderately, if you're not drinking at all, you actually have a much worse chance of getting heart disease. Compounded on that is that not only do you have a worse chance of getting heart disease, but you also stand a greater liability of dying from heart disease. So moderate, consistent drinkers both limit their chances of getting heart disease, and they also reduce their chances of if they do get it, they have lower chance of actually dying from it. This is actually well established in the medical community, but it's just simply not widely known. And that's largely because there are some pretty strong special interest lobby groups that don't want to share that message because they're afraid that it'll be interpreted as a green flag for alcohol abuse. And no one wants that to happen. So I understand the concern, but preventing knowledge is never the solution. Informed decisions are always better than uninformed. Fortunately, what we have right now is a very uninformed public on the health benefits of alcohol. Now, getting to beer specifically, compared to, say, wine, which actually has done a pretty decent job of educating the public. If you ask most people, they might say, oh, well, red wine is supposed to be good for you, right? A glass of red wine with dinner, that's supposed to be good for you, but nothing else. The truth is, the red wine industry did some of the earliest research on the health effects of alcohol. So they did when they found the shocking results that, hey, guess what, drinking moderately is actually good for you, they got their research out there in the public and were able to garner a lot of media attention around it. The sad news is that other industries haven't been able to make such a splash, but the fact is the source of alcohol doesn't matter in terms of the heart-healthy effects of alcohol. What is different among different sources of alcohol is that beer, compared to wine, has a whole different set of nutritional impacts, beer being a fermented grain, whereas wine being fermented grapes. Grain has a lot of carbohydrates and a lot of protein, and compared to wine, has a much more robust nutritional profile than wine does. So beer has the healthful impact of the alcohol, but it also has the healthful impact of nutrition itself, and that gets back to what I was saying earlier about fermentation of grains in general being a way of unlocking nutrition. And so, the bottom line is drink moderately and consistently. The consistent part of that is also important because the studies also show that drinking 10 beers on Friday night and then not drinking for a week and drinking 10 on the next Friday night, that's not healthy. What is healthy is having a couple beers every day. Binging is unhealthy. Consistent overconsumption is unhealthy. Not drinking at all is a health negative, but moderate, consistent drinking has dramatically positive, healthful impact.
And that was Christopher O'Brien, author of the book Fermenting Revolution, How to Drink Beer and Save the World, published by British Columbia's New Society Publishers. You can learn more about the book by visiting Chris's website at beeractivist.com. Chris spoke to Deconstructing Dinner in July 2007, and he lives in Silver Spring, Maryland. Again, today's episode is archived on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca and the July 8th, 2010 broadcast. You'll also find some unheard audio from my conversation with Christopher archived there.
I walked into a beer tavern to give a girl a nice time. I had $45 when I entered. When I left, I had one dime. Wasn't that a beer-drinking woman? Don't you know, man, don't you know? She was a beer-drinking woman. I don't wanna see her no more. When I've been down to my last dime, she says, darling, I know you're not through. I told her, yes, baby doll, and the diploma belongs to you. Wasn't that a beer-drinking woman? Don't you know, man, don't you know? Lord, that was a beer-drinking woman. I don't want to see her no more. She'd often say, excuse me a minute, I've got to step around here. And every time she'd come back, she'd say, daddy, buy me another quart of beer. Wasn't that a beer-drinking woman? Don't you know, man, don't you know? She was a beer-drinking woman. I don't want to see her no more. I said, I've got to step off, baby. Are there anything else you like? She says, daddy, I'll keep this table if you'll promise me you'll be back. Wasn't that a beer-drinking woman? Don't you know, man, don't you know? She was a beer-drinking woman. I don't want to see her no more. I'm sorry, baby, but I only have one more dime. She said, daddy, buy me a small bottle of beer so I can concentrate my mind. Wasn't that a beer-drinking woman? Don't you know, man, don't you know? What kind of woman was that? Well, she was a beer-drinking woman. I don't want to see her no more.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner, produced in Nelson, British Columbia at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY. I'm John Steinman. On today's show, we're revisiting some past segments that we've aired here on the show over the past few years. In the last quarter of the episode, we'll look back on our March 13th, 2008 broadcast in part two of our periodic series, Deconstructing Dinner in Our Schools. The series was launched to examine how food and agricultural issues make their way into educational settings, with this segment having featured Kodiak Maraski, a 10-year-old Nelson, British Columbia resident who chose a very unique topic to present to his grade 4 classmates. Kodiak's presentation actually came about from a visit to the Deconstructing Dinner website, where a link to the now well-known animated series of short films titled The Matrix was posted. The creation of the films was funded by GRACE, a North American-wide initiative based in New York City that has launched many highly informative online resources, which include, among others, sustainabletable.org and eatwellguide.org. The Matrix has earned a number of awards for its effective and creative method of sharing the hidden stories of where the vast majority of North American meat originates. Kodiak watched the film and it had a profound impact. His resulting commitment to then share what he learned with others demonstrated the impact that learning the truth behind our food can have on children, and in doing so help shape a different and more responsible food system.
Well, I was sitting down on the couch and having a great time doing nothing, and my mom was scanning through your website and she found the Matrix. And afterwards I said, man, that's just scary, some of that stuff. What the factory farming is and how they don't tell people and how bad it is. And basically they showed a pork farm where all the pigs were stuck in these little stalls. And then there's this pig and a cow and a chicken that were all against it. And they and then in one of them it showed how the cows are put into these milking things that like suck the milk out. And then they spend their time between there and this the feeds lots. And then the babies, how they get fed blood after they get started on milk and then get fed blood and stuff. Then they went into the factory and showed how the workers were getting hurt and how the manure, when they made it really fast, was dripping on the meat and stuff.
Certainly not the images most 10-year-olds would associate with farming. If you haven't yet seen the films that Kodiak is referring to, you can visit them online at thematrix.com. As mentioned, it was from watching The Matrix that Kodiak became inspired to share this information with his grade 4 classmates. In the spirit of deconstructing dinner, he titled his presentation, What's in Your Pizza?
I'd discovered that whenever someone goes down to sit and down and eat a pizza, they don't really think about, they just go, oh, this is so good. Oh, I'm going to want this again. But they don't think that, okay, here, this came out of a factory farm where all the animals are sick. This came out of a factory farm where diseases is ending up in the milk. This came out of a factory farm where they're being sprayed, where tons of pesticides are. It has the dairy, the meat, grain, and the fruit, basically a vegetable. So I was able to cover everything pretty much in one, cover it all in the pizza. That's why I chose it.
Kodiak Moraski was at the time a grade 4 student at Blewett Elementary School just outside of Nelson, British Columbia. And Deconstructing Dinner sat in on his What's in Your Pizza presentation. He stood in front of a poster that he put together of images taken on the many factory farms that produce the bulk of North America's meat, dairy, and eggs. His first step was to deconstruct the pepperoni on the pizza.
Yeah, you can. Boys and girls, you need to take that energy you just received from the band concert and put it into excellent audience skills, please. That means you're seated appropriately, you're using your eyes and your ears for listening. You're paying attention to someone just like you would want them to pay attention to you.
So I did What's in My Pizza, and I traced everything back to where it came from out of the farm. There, this is the pepperoni, so that's the pork. So in the factory farm, and it's basically a big metal building that contains a lot of animals. So these are all pigs there. These are all pictures of live animals in the factory farm. Here you can see the piglets are crammed in so tightly they have to stack on top of each other to fit in there, or else they'd just be packed. Like, they just pack them in quite tightly, and they can hardly lay down, and they can hardly turn, like, most animals can't turn around in the holding stall. In the factory farm, they're basically fed and given water, then all the rest of their time they just have to stand there. And they're given about 2 years before they're killed in the slaughterhouse because they don't have enough space to get any exercise, which leads to muscle disease and causes skin problems. So after a few years, they'll be put onto a big truck where they're packed so tightly, where often the animals have their limbs completely snapped from the weight of other scared animals. Then in cold weather, the pigs will often have their skin frozen to the sides of the slaughter truck. Then when they get to the slaughterhouse, many animals are so sick that they cannot even walk off the slaughter truck. Therefore, they're kicked off or dragged off. And then they're taken into the slaughterhouse. And that's just like what they do in there. I'm not going to even mention. So then after they're killed, they'll butcher them. Well, actually, in the once they get there, they'll be stunned before having their hair burned off. But most times the stunning is improper, so they go through having their hair burned off by a metal plate with still completely conscious, and then are slaughtered, then butchered, and then they'll be turned into pepperoni for the pizzas, and they'll be turned into ham and steak and or pork chops, not steak, and
bacon
and other pork products.
Same pork.
Until they're left with the hide and hooves, which is boiled down into gelatin, which is the main ingredient in gelatin or in Jello, and is also found in marshmallows.
gummy bears, gummy worms, starbursts, skittles, and certain kinds of guacamole.
And you're listening to clips from What's in Your Pizza, a school project presented by Kodiak Moraski, a 10-year-old student at Blewett Elementary School. Needless to say, the grade 4 class that Kodiak presented to was rather shocked at learning where some of their food comes from. Not a topic discussed in such detail in most grade 4 classrooms. Kodiak was inspired to share this information with his classmates after watching the animated film The Matrix, which exposes some of the irresponsible practices that can be found within industrial meat, dairy, and egg production. After the pepperoni was deconstructed, Kodiak then traced the origins of the pizza's cheese. Introduced to his fellow grade 4 students was a disease that most children would never associate with where their cheese comes from, but is one that affects over 35% of all dairy cows in North America, mastitis, a disease that can significantly increase the somatic or white blood cell count in milk. While the presence of such cells is not seen as a threat to human health, it is seen as a threat to milk quality.
It's also found in jelly beans. And that's with the pork, and then the cows, the cheese on the pizza comes from cow's cream. And here's a picture of a cow that's in one of the holding stalls and has an infection which causes some, like, even pus and blood to go straight into the milk, which goes straight into the cheese on your pizza. That's what we eat. Then that's a cow that's just so sick he can hardly stand. And then this is a cow that has been raised in a nice pasture by farmers that care about their animals, and so that's a happy cow. These two pictures right here, this one's kind of small, but those two pictures are pictures of cows in their feedlots where they're crammed with their heads into those middle bars to eat.
Moving on from the animals involved in the production of Kodiak's pizza, he then chose to focus on the crust, and he talked about where the wheat for the crust comes from.
Here for the pizza crust, that's wheat, and the wheat, so far in Canada, the government's refused to grow genetically engineered wheat, but Monsanto, which is a bad company, is constantly asking almost every year if they can come in and grow their wheat, and what they've done is they've taken the wheat and made it immune to this chemical which where there's a truck, and what they'll do is they'll just get an airplane basically to fly over the wheat fields and spray this chemical down onto the wheat while causing all frogs, snakes, mice, any animal, any plant in the wheat field to die of because of the serious pesticides, and then the wheat is left to grow, and the wheat will end up in the pizza with the pesticide often still on it.
Now, one topic that we cover here on the show quite often is the transgenic engineering and manipulation of foods, also known as genetically engineered food. Had someone told me that the topic was being taught in a grade 4 classroom, I would probably not believe it. But sure enough, 10-year-old Kodiak Moraski decided to take that task on himself, and it was one that he thought to be important to share as part of his What's in Your Pizza presentation.
Then these are happy pigs that are that aren't factory farmed, and here, this is Frankenfoods. Basically, what GE is where they take one cell from one plant or animal organism and take it out of that animal and put it into another animal to cause something else to happen. For instance, scientists have created glow-in-the-dark mice by crossing jellyfish and mice together, and they've created red and green ones, and I'm not sure they've created other colors. They've also created a goat that was crossed with a spider, and whenever they milk it, spider silk comes out in the milk. That's why, I personally have refused to eat any more food that I don't know where it comes from, just after knowing where it actually comes from. It comes from somewhere where the pigs can't even turn around, somewhere where the cows end up with blood going straight into the milk because they're so poorly treated. So that's why I don't eat it, and I hope some people will stop eating it too.
Now, coming back to my conversation with Kodiak that I had following his presentation, I was no doubt eager to learn more about how such shocking information was handled by someone at such a young age, and he shared what he found most shocking upon learning more about the state of the North American food supply.
About how the government so far has refused to let Monsanto grow its GE wheat in Canada, but how they're asking every year, and how quite a few countries are saying, no, if you grow GE wheat in Canada, we won't buy it from Canada. And I'd say it'd be a big problem if Canada was basically contaminated by GE wheat. We pretty much have to say no GE wheat in Canada if we're going to keep selling it to all the big other countries.
Kodiak's project certainly highlighted one important lesson, that clearly there is an interest among children as young as 10 years old to learn about where their food comes from, and the many truths that seem to not become part of standard curriculum. I even asked Kodiak if he would like to see this topic discussed more in his school.
Definitely. I'd say if there's a program on what you eat at your common restaurant, I'd love it if they could do that in a school.
And that was Kodiak Moraski, who was 10 years old when he presented his What's in Your Pizza project to his fellow grade 4 students at Blewett Elementary School. The school is located just outside of Nelson, British Columbia. And I'll end today's show with one last clip from the question and answer period following Kodiak's presentation. Some of his classmates announced that they would no longer eat any candy made with animal products, while other comments indicated a seeming lack of trust for the Canadian government. The young girl who you're about to faintly hear in the background asks the question, why doesn't the government do anything about this? Referring, of course, to the irresponsible practices found within industrial meat, dairy, and egg production. She then asks whether or not she can sue the government. And another classmate responds to her question by saying, no, they'll kill you.
Doesn't the government do something about that?
As long as the companies keep paying him money to let them do it, he hasn't.
Are you allowed to sue the government?
The other problem is farms are actually set up, so they've got their own security guards on so that people don't find out about this. And it's only after people have pretended to be workers and gone in to find out what really is happening, that people have started to learn about what's really in it.
Okay, well, we are at lunchtime, actually.
E-I-E-I-O, and on this farm he had a pig. E-I-E-I-O, oink oink here and oink oink there, here an oink, there an oink, everywhere an oink oink. Old MacDonald had a...
I am Mufius, and I know a lot about you. Have you heard of the Meatrix?
The Meatrix?
Do you want to know what it is?
Okay.
The Meatrix is all around you, Leo. It is the story we tell ourselves about where meat and animal products come from. This family farm is a fantasy. Take the blue pill and stay here in the fantasy. Take the red pill and I'll show you the truth.
And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio show is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.